This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Many of us recall our history teachers telling us in school that knowing history helps us understand the present and helps us ensure we aren't doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past. A new book by a researcher of human prehistory says that exploring the past can help us understand the future. In her book, Human Prehistory, Deborah Barsky focuses on the invention of the earliest stone tools that Homo sapiens and their ancestors built, and how they help define what it means to be human. Deborah Barsky is a researcher at the Catalan Institute of Human Paleoecology and Social Evolution and associate professor at the Open University of Catalonia and Rovira y Virgili University in Tarragona, Spain. And she joins me now to discuss her book, Human Prehistory, Exploring the Past to Understand the Future. Welcome to the program, Deborah.
Thank you very much, Sonali. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So first, let's define prehistory. We may think of those of us who aren't history experts or prehistory researchers may think of everything that's happened in the past as simply history. What is prehistory?
Indeed. Well, prehistory, when we're talking specifically about human prehistory, so what we're referring to is really the very long period of time before writing, really. What we prehistorians work with are mainly, especially for the older periods, are mainly stones and bones and, you know, whatever the fossil record can bring to us from the deep past. So in more recent periods, when we have written documents or iconography, for example, in proto-historic periods, interpretations can be made a little bit, let's say, easier. Whereas when we're working in prehistory, we're working with silent stones, silent bones, and the stratigraphical contexts in which they're found. So we really have to extract the maximum information that we can from these contexts and from these cultural markers, I suppose you could call them, for the very ancient periods of our human prehistory.
So what are the timescales we're talking about here? X number of years ago, are we talking about pre-civilization?
Yeah, the timescales tend to be pretty scary for maybe our listeners who are not accustomed to working in, you know, such long chronologies. But generally, we can consider, well, what makes us human? And when along this very long timeline can we find in the archaeological record some evidence of this becoming human? So really, I think we're working with two main criteria, one being bipedalism, which is considered today as one of the starting points from which our ancestors began to bifurcate along the human lineage.
So basically started to walk on two legs.
Yes. And the second would be toolmaking. Toolmaking as a very important bifurcation along the hominin pathway towards, let's say, becoming human. Of course, it's important to remember that we're not talking about a straight linear evolutionary pathway, but something that's really rather bushy and complex, with a lot of stops and starts along the way. And also it's important to remember that the fossil record and the archaeological record is really very fragmentary. And the further we go back in time, the more fragmentary this record is. So it's like a puzzle that we're trying to put together daily. And even as our own technologies are improving, well, we're also improving the ways that we can locate finds and study them and also share them with the public.
So are we talking on the terms of 100,000 years too? I mean, you know, how old is the earliest tool what defines a human-made tool?
Well, the oldest stone tools that we can recognize in the archaeological record are around 3 million years old. And
Wow.
they're found, yeah, they're found in Africa. But these are recognizable stone tools. So this point of emergence is important, I think, to underline. You know, it's probable that early hominins were using stone for a very long time prior to actually shaping it into tools that we can recognize today. And when I say what we can recognize today, well, if you're out in a savanna landscape somewhere in Africa looking for stone tools, what you can recognize is something that presents a kind of systematic, right? Stones that are broken in a non-systematic way would just look like broken stones and would be unrecognizable to us. But it's possible that, you know, hominins were using stone for a very long time, perhaps for throwing, probably for pounding activities like we can observe, for example, in some contexts with chimpanzees and bonobos, for example, nutcracking activities. So perhaps breaking inadvertently stones in the beginning and finding these broken bits of stone useful, perhaps to perform different activities, and then making the choice to actually purposefully extract flakes from bits of stone. And that's when you get into the systematic, and that's around 3 million years old. We have a site now in Kenya, which is dated to 3.3 million years ago, which was only discovered, I think it was published in 2015. So it's quite a recent discovery. So the dates are always being pushed back actually even further.
Wow. Are these timescales evolutionary timescales? Are these timescales across which our species may have biologically evolved?
Yes, and that's one of the very interesting aspects as well of studying these very ancient techno-complexes, which we call for the oldest, the Oldowan, after the eponymous site of Olduvai Gorge. It's fascinating because they were made by hominins that were very different from ourselves, of course. Homo habilis, which is the first Homo, actually emerges in Africa around 2.8 million years ago, 2.5, 2.8 million years ago. So around the same time or just after the first recognizable stone tools. And we believe today that other kinds of hominins were probably also making these first stone tools, Australopithecines and Paranthropus, because another thing to remember is that our genus Homo actually shared these African landscapes with other kinds of hominins over many thousands of years.
Right. Today, Homo sapiens are the only only species within the Homo genus. Am I saying that correctly? Left?
Yes, you are.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Well, most of us have heard of Neanderthals. That's another one, right?
Of course,
yeah.
Homo neanderthalensis, and actually the hominin family tree has been growing over the last quarter of a century or so. And as we discover new sites and as the dates are changing, it's been fascinating to see that since the emergence of Homo sapiens, which is now placed at a much earlier time than previously believed, around 300,000 years ago, thanks to a relatively new discovery from Morocco, Jebel Irud site, 300,000 years old for our genus and species, Homo sapiens. And new discoveries being made in Eurasia as well of different kinds of hominins arriving, migrating into different areas of Eurasia around the same time as our own species. And so the cohabitation of Homo sapiens with, let's say, Neanderthals or even Denisovans was actually going on for a period that was longer than previously believed.
So what did the tool making tell, or what does the tool making tell us about what it means to be human then. If there were Homo sapiens that were actually, and our related ancestors, actually carving these tools to pound food or whatever, maybe hunt, what does that tell us about being human in terms of the social relevance to today's society? I know I'm sort of fast forwarding really fast, but for me, this is what's fascinating to us today, right? Those of us who are not, not in the thick of the academic prehistory, what does that prehistory tell us about who we are today?
Well, it's interesting when you go back to the oldest, let's say, stone tools, and see their evolutionary pathway, let's say from the Oldowan to the Acheulean. Those are the two oldest techno-complexes known to humankind. We can see different processes going on that are still going on today. And one of them is complexification, or let's say another process as well is acceleration. So the first stone tools are relatively simple or opportunistic, let's say, but they do have a systematic. And they were made by techniques that needed to be learnt and transmitted. And these techniques that are learnt and transmitted, therefore, are necessarily cultural, because that is the very definition of culture, isn't it, when we're talking about transmission of knowledge and such. And as we go through time, we can see this complexification in tool making, and even tools at the beginning of the Acheulean that are shaped harmoniously with, let's say, symmetry, like the Acheulean bifaces. So it's rather difficult to learn to make an Acheulean biface. And so we can say that the humans were investing in the learning process. They were investing in culture, because obviously tool making was providing the hominins with some kind of advantages, let's say, compared with other large carnivores that were roaming in the landscape alongside them. And some neuroscientific experiments have been done looking more specifically at the human brain during the stone napping process, and in particular during the making of more complex tool types. And it was found that the parts of the brain that are activated during this process are the same as those that are used, for example, for language, for volumetric planning, for prediction. So in a way, these parts of the brain are co-opted towards tool making. And this can sort of explain, I think, in many ways, the increasing brain cerebral capacity of hominins through time that seems to happen in synchronicity with the complexification of the tool making process itself.
So it sounds as though a lot of what we now know about human biology offers hints about and allows researchers like yourself to extrapolate to what might have been happening on the order of a few million years ago with our species.
Yes, well, the field of human prehistory is exponentially expanding as well with all of the new technologies that are being created. I mean, it's a specialty that embraces really all sciences, we can say, for locating sites, for dating sites, for studying the artifacts that they yield, and for studying also the stratigraphical contexts in which they are found. So really, we're using, you know, biological sciences, but as well many different kinds of specialties that are including computer specialties these days, 3D analysis, all kinds of you know, modern technologies that are being applied to archaeology and to human prehistory, and that are enabling us not only to find more sites, but to date them more precisely, and to study the materials much more rapidly than before, and to share this data using innovative museographical strategies. And that is sort of awakening also in the general public, I think, this interest, which is a natural interest. I think everybody is interested to know, you know, where do we come from? And especially today, where are we going? Where is the human species going? Why are we the only species left today on the earth? And what is our position relative to other life forms?
Right.
You know, so
in your book,
all of this really can be related, I think, to technology and this major bifurcation that occurred some 3 million years ago when we chose to invest in something that is extra somatic. It's an adaptive strategy that is outside of the biological realm. And indeed, there are other tool-making animals. Some people claim culture and other kinds of animal species, but none of these species has developed technology to the point that humans have. And so it's important, I think, to follow this evolutionary pathway to see how we invested in this, why we invested in it, how it changed our brain, how we came to invest more in symbolic thought processes as well that are linked to language, that are linked to the development of these specific areas of the brain, and inevitably linked to tool making as well.
Deborah Barsky's book is Human Prehistory, Exploring the Past to Understand the Future. What have you learned and other researchers learned about human prehistory that helps us understand, to, for lack of a better word, tribalism, right? So there's a lot of, there may be hints about how humans have treated other species, but what about how we've treated one another, particularly groups of one another that we might perceive as different from ourselves, even though, of course, we're part of the same species?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And I do talk about this in my book as a particularly interesting point. If we look at the process of cultural complexification, we do get to a point where we can see cultural differences within each technocomplex. And this begins as early as the Acheulean, I claim, where we have reached the point of sufficient cultural complexity where each hominin group can develop some kind of idiosyncrasies, let's say, in the way that they make bifaces. So they can contrast this cultural material with the way perhaps that another hominin group is making their bifaces. And so they're going to—
And remind us what you mean by bifaces again?
Oh, it's, well, it could be any kind of tool really, but a biface is a symmetrical tear-shaped tool that is emblematic of the Acheulean period. So these perceived cultural differences, because we don't have any biological differences, of course, we modern humans are all one and the same, but we have a lot of cultural differences, and we can trace back the beginnings of these cultural differences to these little idiosyncrasies that occurred within even relatively simple toolkits. And the capacity for humans as well to remain within one geographical context, like, let's say, early hominins of the Oldowan and the Acheulean periods were migrating into different lands, exploring into different lands. But once fire making was established and once tool making reached a sufficiently high level of quality and capacity, hominins were able to remain within a specific geographical region. So they were able to perceive their cultural differences in relation to the geographical region in which they inhabited. And this, to me, was the beginnings of the first ideas of, you know, let's say borders, some kind of symbolic dividing line between different human groups, but that is culturally based, because there's no biological basis for it. And this is something that was further developed through time and that we have established in intonation states today, which, you know, it's something that is still very present today, but which is a completely symbolic construction. So I think we can learn a lot from prehistory if we go back to the emergence phase of these so-called differences, and if we consider them for what they are, which is really cultural constructions, the symbolic constructions that we have invented to make differentiations between different human groups. But in today's globalized world, these differences are being effaced and have less and less, are making less and less sense.
Speaking of globalization, let's talk about man's relationship, humans' relationship to nature. So there's the relationship between groups of humans, groups perceived to be different, the advent of borders. You can think about the origins of racism and imperialism, et cetera, in that way. But what about the fact that we have found more and more innovative ways to disentangle ourselves from nature in ways that, you know, we're reminded of often by indigenous groups. Today, indigenous groups are trying to remind us that humans have to live in harmony with nature if we are to survive. But where did that split happen? I think often we might think of it as happening with the advent of industrialized agriculture, but did it happen even earlier?
I don't know if you can actually pinpoint an exact point in time where the alienation from nature occurred. I think the development of technologies has given a human some kind of illusion of superiority, some kind of desire to be somehow different from the rest of the animal world, which is, you know, I mean, we remain inevitably linked to nature. We are biological beings, and there's no denying that. But people are searching in technologies to differentiate themselves from the rest of the natural world. And we can see today that this is having very serious repercussions on not only the human species, but all other species on the planet. So whether or not you can actually pinpoint an exact point in time where this, I see it rather as a process. And as our technologies have developed ever more complex and superior, let's say, this is continuing.
And so, there be a is there a way to understand from prehistory and from what we've learned about prehistory, is there a way to understand religion? Religion may be something that kind of is a bridge between you know, our alienation from nature as well as our propensity to have tribalistic differences with one another. Why is there a human need to believe in an entity that we cannot actually see and touch, that that we might want to believe is sort of pulling the strings behind the veil? Where does religion come from, as far as you can understand?
Religion, yes, I think we can go back in time and try to, well, instead of religion, I would call it perhaps spiritualism, because religion gives the idea of institutionalized religion, which is more of a modern construct. But spiritualism, which is very difficult, of course, to perceive in the prehistoric record, does become apparent in some particular contexts. For example, people often talk about, let's say, the first burials that we recognize among the Neanderthals, some 200,000, 150,000 years ago. When there is intentional burial, that suggests that there is some kind of belief, perhaps in life after death, some kind of belief that it is important to offer the defunct a particular context in order for this individual to continue on, let's say, into an afterlife. So burials are really considered one of the first inklings of some kind of spiritual sentiment, let's say, in our hominin ancestors. So, I mean, where does the whole religion come from? I mean, there's still questions that we humans are not able to answer, and one of those being, you know, what happens after death, let's say. Today we use science to try to answer as many questions as we possibly can, but there are still many unknowns, and we humans need to fill in those gaps, and religion is a way for people to fill in the gaps, let's say.
Right.
Let's say religion tends to be very strong in peoples in low-income countries, perhaps, where suffering is rife, where children are dying inexplicably to their parents, from where there's a lot of cruelty. Religious sentiments tend to be stronger in these contexts because they have to try to somehow justify or you know, reason to be able to survive and to live with these incredibly difficult experiences. So
what about science? You know, today we talk about the scientific method, but really it is a very human thing to try to understand the logic of how things work. It is how we have evolved. Even if we haven't identified the scientific method, you know, hundreds of years ago or thousands of years ago, presumably humans used the scientific method to build things, to make some sort of progress, to build technologies. Even we being able to do science itself is also a very human thing, right? And one could argue that even creating those tools that we started talking about is a sort of approach to inroad to science.
Yes, indeed. Transforming the world around us and combining different materials to create new materials. I mean, one example, of course, would be fire making, which in the oldest contexts, let's say in South Africa, I believe now is the oldest context where fire making has been attested at around 1 million years ago at the site of Wonderwork. And we have here something that is really transformative in so many ways, gives so much power to humans to fight off other carnivores, for hunting, for transforming materials, creating new materials even later on by heating. Settling into lands with harsher climates, staying late into the night to perhaps recount stories. Fire was a very transformative technology. And these are, you know, early scientific achievements, certainly. Some argue as well, for example, that the use of ochre also in South Africa, in another cave site called Blombos, this time in a more recent context, around 100,000 years ago, where ochre was worked being combined with other materials like animal.
Basically a color ochre, right.
Exactly. So it's this idea of transforming materials to create new ones to fill our needs and desires. So that's kind of a power giving thing when you consider it.
Well, Deborah, I hear your cat wants us to wrap up our conversation, so it's a good time for us to say goodbye. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Very interesting and fascinating subject. Thank you for helping translate some of your academic work to, you know, the rest of us, and putting it in terms that have a context for our modern world. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your questions.
My guest has been Deborah Barsky, researcher at the Catalan Institute of Human Paleoecology and Social Evolution. And we've been discussing her book, Human Prehistory, Exploring the Past to Understand the Future. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.